It's a play about a man who's falling apart and a man who has a brutal past and a brutal present. And they start to close in on him, and the gravity of the life that he has lived for the past 500 years sort of crushes onto him, and he struggles with that.
So Michael von Siebenberg is the title character.
Yes.
And he is a vampire.
Yeah, he's my idea of a vampire. I think, you know, there's some people who are, oh, yes, okay, I see that. And other people are like, no, a vampire has fangs and sucks blood. So I guess what makes him a vampire is that he has to kill people in order to live, and that he has to consume the essence of people in order to continue on. And also that he has this kind of murky connection to a brutal past, which is kind of anchored in the Balkans and the where East met West in the Middle Ages.
Immortality and the immortal being are pretty big pop culture motifs these days. I mean, the whole idea of living forever comes with its own kind of existential burdens.
Yeah.
How is he dealing with his many centuries?
I think it's on his, I think it's troubling him, you know, and it's bothering him, you know, the cost of living, so to speak, is becoming it comes to a breaking point in the story.
Okay.
So he's tormented, he's haunted. And I think one of the big questions of the play is he a monster or is he a human being? Can you be a human being and be brutal, you know? Or do you, at some point, do you stop being human because of the things that you do to survive? So I think this is another one of the questions that the play tries to grapple with.
You talked about the idea of consuming life in order to live, and consumption is a recurring theme that drives a lot of your work. And
yeah.
You're in Town, it's about the overconsumption of water and the consequences of that. And Yeast Nation, it's also about the consequences of growth. Is immortality the opposite of that growth? Or how does this factor in, I guess, into the larger themes of your work?
I think, that's a great question. And I think the thing that I brood about and sort of wring my hands about is sustainability,
mm-hmm.
and the improbability of sustainability and how nations rise and fall. And I think this play, too, is sort of preoccupied with that, because I think our national moment in our own history, it feels like we're butting up against a period which is perhaps the frontiers of what we can be in terms of power, in terms of wealth, in terms of our place in the world, and that the 20th century has been called the American century, and that was a period when, after the Second World War, and America was left standing alone as the world's superpower. But I think we're entering into a different period, and so I think the parallel is, as you know, as America is, I don't want to say crumbling, but it's going to be transforming. Michael is crumbling and transforming, and I think how you step into that is what will make the difference. How we, you know, how we brace ourselves, and whether we will take this path over the next century with grace or with turmoil, I think that's up to us. So that's sort of, in an indirect way, that's what's on this play's mind as well.
So so our lead character, Michael, is 500 years old?
Yeah. Yeah, well,
ish?
Yeah, about 500 years
okay.
old, yes.
Is he a modern man and an immortal, or is he still is he still from the 16th century but living and existing in today's world?
Yeah, he's definitely a late medieval man, mm-hmm. with a late medieval sort of point of view and perspective. And he's trying to pass. He's trying to pass for, you know, contemporary, and he does the best he can.
Okay.
But he can't help but give himself away from time to time. And he works with a wingman, a character named Sammy, who's much better at passing. And you learn in the course of the play that this is sort of a tag team operation where Sammy talks him up to his dates. And he has this kind of quasi special power, which we call the googly eyes, where he'll sort of transfix women with these speeches of medieval sumptuousness and get them interested in his friend. And so so Sammy is better at passing than Michael, but I think part of Michael's charm is that he isn't contemporary. He's elegant, and he has these old ways, and there's a draw to that, particularly now with, you know, I guess we live in the era of the man-child. So he's sort of the opposite of the man-child, which is part of his appeal.
Which is interesting, because then he also never grows older.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, he's sort of a Peter Pan in that way.
So you've worked extensively in the short form before as part of the Neo-Futurists troupe, and also as the author of many short plays, including a 10-minute play in the Humana Festival, which has one of my favorite titles, An Examination of the Whole Playwright-Actor Relationship, presented as some kind of cop show parody in 2010. So can you tell us a little bit about your process of developing ideas? How do you know when a story is a short story or a longer story?
Oh, that's a good question, too. I write shorts all the time because they're really easy. I shouldn't say they're easy, but they're very contained. It's something that often you'll sort of, an idea will come in the shower or doing dishes or on your bicycle or something like that. Usually when my body is preoccupied with some kind of task, that's when most ideas come to me. And then whether that's a play or a short, I think depends on how much of the world sort of opens up in the process of writing it down. So it begins murkily with a snippet of dialogue or just sort of an image. In for this play, it was just the flash of an image of a middle-aged man pouring a glass of wine for a younger woman. That's sort of how this began, just specifically in Ed's very immediacy. So for me, if there's something compelling and interesting that of one of those little flashes, then the writing process just becomes one of just exploring what that is and trying to answer questions and, sort of breathing a little bit of life into the people in the scene. And if that opens up into a larger world, then that, I think, is when it's a play. And if it feels sort of contained and satisfying, and one sort of just one idea in a way, then that's a short.
How about the idea of the play versus the musical, especially since you, I think Your In Town has been really credited as kind of redefining the musical genre for the new millennium. How do you feel about writing sort of plays versus musicals? When do you know when a character needs to break out in song versus just straight dialogue?
There's something, this play is heightened in its own way. It's very theatrical in its own way. I think for me, for the musicals that I've written so far, there's something at a height, there's some kind of heightened either stylistic or emotional pitch that the story seems to be sort of hurtling down. And musicals are very architectural. They're very structured. So if there's something about the story that feels sort of structured in that way, that feels like it lends itself to distinct segmented scenes that rise to sort of the emotional level where a song could happen. So I think it's there are plays that I've written that have become musicals, and their musical ideas like, no, this is actually a play. I think it all happens to do with the scope of the thing. Mm. Musicals are, there's an epic sweep to them. So that's how it feels for me.
So this is your third entry, I believe, in the Humana Festival.
Yes, yeah.
So you worked on the 2009 Apprentice Anthology Brink, and then Cop Show Parody in the 2010 10-minute plays. But this is your first full-length Humana play, and I know that you've debuted your work in the places like the New York Fringe Festival, for instance. What does giving a new play a launch pad out of the Humana Festival do for the life of the play? What are your hopes for it? Why this play in this festival?
The great thing about the festival is that there's a fantastic creative team at the Actors Theater that are at your disposal you know, there's a fantastic design team that is connected to the theater itself, the Pamela Brown, where we're going to be. And there's just there's a lot of support. So that's great. And to get a full production of a new play here is great. It's perhaps a little bit shorter, because it's a festival, it's a little bit shorter than it might be if it were, I guess, at a regional premiere.
Mm-hmm.
But in exchange for the time, you have a great community of people to work with. And, you know, the Humana Festival is one of the premier festivals of its kind, where new work is looked at and considered for possible life beyond it. So I think, you know, all the authors, I'm sure, are hoping that perhaps some kind of life will follow, and that you'll learn. I mean, the play that you have in your head is different than the play on the page. And the play on the page does not survive the ordeal of rehearsal and mounting a production. And then when it's up, then you'll see what it is. And hopefully you've done your work well enough that it is clear and of a piece and all those things. But you don't know until it's up.
Well, I know a lot of playwrights go on to write for TV and film, especially cable TV now seems to be sucking up a lot of our great playwrights' time and talents, which is great. There's a lot of great work being done on cable right now. Are you doing any writing for the screen? Are you strictly a stage writer?
No, I would like to. I'm a fan of, you know, all, you know, this seems to be sort of a golden era of sorts of shows with, you know, Deadwood and Mad Men and Boardwalk Empire and all these fantastic shows, Breaking Bad, you know. So I would, it's something that I would very much like to do, but I've been focused on, I sort of tumble forth from project to project, and so far I've just been doing theater projects, but it's something that I would hope to do, and hope to do both. I mean, I think the ideal career is one where you can live in both worlds simultaneously.
Well, what do you think is theater's role during this sort of golden age of small screen?
I guess, the thing about theater is, I think you can be, I guess there are two things. You can be bolder in some ways, stylistically, because the it's smaller. It does not have to sell a product. It doesn't have to satisfy an audience in the millions. So I think that freedom is important. Number one. And number two, I think, is we live not only in the era of TV, but also of the internet and Facebook. And I'm very I've been watching the transformation of the music industry from afar as someone who has no connection to it, and seeing how it's been turned upside down, where you have people release records to promote a tour as opposed to doing a tour to promote a record, which all says to me that the live experience is important. Maybe not again, but it's like, it's a reminder that there's no substitute for it. So theater, again, has this role where it's a once in a lifetime thing. Every performance is different. You don't really know what's going to happen. It hasn't been frozen in time. It's human beings in front of you, and that's true for the actors as well as the audience. So mining and marshaling the energy that happens when people come together to consider a story, I think that's what will always keep theater unique and strong. And that's just it's good to remind yourself of that as someone involved in it.
Great. Thanks a lot for joining us today, Greg.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.